Welcome to another edition of the Exponential Podcast. I'm Todd Wilson, Director of Exponential. We're thrilled you're taking advantage of this free resource that was recorded at the Exponential Conference. It's part of a library of hundreds of hours of free training. In our mission to equip church planning leaders, we seek to distribute as many free resources as possible. Visit exponential.org to learn more and to check out the programming for the upcoming Exponential Conference.
So glad to be here. Quick kind of intro of who I am, what we're doing here, and then if I tell you what we're doing in this and you don't want to stay, then you can leave and someone else can have your seat. So, no, but a little bit on background. So I did spend 9 years in a parachurch organization, my kind of first 9 years of my adult life. Started attending a church that was in the area, which ended up being Granger Community Church, which was meeting in a movie theater. It was a church plant, very, very young, couple hundred people at the time. Set up, tear down, all that stuff. My wife and I fell in love with the church, started attending regularly, became members, and then was invited to join the staff in 1994. So then kind of got to go on a ride of a lifetime as the church kind of grew over the next 20 years. I stayed there till 2014. So that was exciting time of just, you know, kind of, you know, everything's new at the beginning and you're figuring everything out and then finding land and building buildings and hiring staff and ultimately adding sites and other, you know, a preschool and other things that kind of make ministry complex. And then 2 years, a little over 2 years ago, kind of felt this call in this sense to something new, to kind of serve the Big C church instead of just the local church. And so joined up the team of Vanderblumen Search Group. I had hired Vanderblumen to help me find a staff person like 2 years before that. And so kind of had gotten to know the team. It was a great experience for me. And I love talking about staffing issues and structural issues and organizational issues with churches. So it was just a natural fit for me. So today we're talking about, and I had to look at the title again yesterday because I'd forgotten what I told them that I was going to talk about. So, but it's four leadership principles related to church staff culture. So you guys are here probably because this topic is of interest to you. Anyone like in a current kind of challenge that's like that it's the reason you're here and you want to hear something about? Anyone want to like be brave and say, hey, yeah, this is my thing right now? Or is it just general?
Down here.
Yeah, down on the floor. Yeah, probably a lot of jumping into conflict navigation and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, okay. All right, well, let's jump in. Four things I'm going to kind of talk about here, and the first one it kind of relates to personal leadership. So, and these are four leadership principles to kind of revolutionize staff culture. So the first one's related to personal leadership. Second one's going to be related to hiring, bringing new people on the team, hiring or selecting people for the team. And then the third and the fourth are going to be specifically related to culture. So we'll jump into this. But first of all, the number one would be to live a life with margins. You know, live a life with margins. I'm really convinced that, you know, if we don't focus on kind of the personal side of leadership, being a leader worth following, then we're going to have a hard time building a sustainable organization. And you see that. You see guys that kind of burn out or they go, you know, hard and strong for a few years and then they kind of lose the energy and they burn out. And I don't know anything about, you know, the integrity of their lives underneath the surface, but I do know if you don't pay attention to that, it's going to catch up with you. So margins, you know, if you, on your page there, you probably have margins. You probably don't write all the way from left to right or top to bottom. You got these margins that kind of give your eyes space to breathe and everything. And in my life, I know margins make me pleasant. When I don't have margin in my life or space in my life, time, space, money, space, when I don't have space, I can get grumpy. I can get tense. If I have margin with my money, it allows me to be generous and to respond to other people's needs, the people around me. If I don't have margin in my money, if I'm just kind of paycheck to paycheck, then I can't be responsive. I can't help others. Margin helps me listen to others. When I don't have margin in my schedule, I don't have time for the person that, you know, flies into my office and has a crisis or needs to tell me about, you know, something going on in their family. If I don't have the margin, I don't have space for that. So margin is significantly helpful in this whole idea of leadership. I think margin, really importantly, margin increases the chance that you'll hear kind of that still small voice of God when he's speaking to you. When you don't have margin and you're just kind of like the needle's up against it all the time, then you're not really taking time to stop and to listen. So some things on margin that I think really help kind of the core of leadership. So carve time in your week for margin. So how I do this is I just stack all my meetings, my formal meetings, on 1 or 2 days a week. And so I have 1 or 2 days which are kind of crazy, where I'm doing all my kind of staff meetings or meetings with key leaders. But that gives me the rest of the week to kind of be more available and to have kind of more of an open door. Gives me a margin to be responsive to others, to more quickly answer my text or my emails. In finances, you know, you live on 80-90% of your income, and then create ways that you can. So for us, we set aside money for our church. We also set aside money just to respond, just to be for those that have needs that come across our paths. And again, if we don't have the margin for that, then we're going to want to help, but we're not going to be able to help. I think part of margin for us as leaders is to minimize the number of life-sucking people in our lives, you know, which we all lead in church. So part of our ministry is about that. But if every relationship we have is taking everything out of us and not pouring anything into us, it's going to drain us dry. So we have to protect that in order and make sure we've got give and take on that. I think with margin too, we have to every now and then just turn off the noise, whether that means, you know, moving your phone out of the way when you get home so you're not being bothered by it lighting up on the table, whether that means making space. My wife and I, every year since we were married, we've been married almost 27 years now, we've done a vacation by ourselves without the kids. And that's just to create margin for us and our marriage and to be able to pour into each other. And that's really important. So think about margin as you're thinking about leadership. One thing related to this is with margin is you have to know yourself. You have to know what brings energy, what brings renewal to yourself. So for some of you folks, how many would raise your hand and say, for me, like being in nature renews me. It helps me. Okay, a bunch of you. That's not for me. That is for my wife. So she knows that about herself. I know about me. There's other things for me. I know for me, one of the things that really breathes life into me is, well, one, I'm an introvert, so time alone does, but it's because I wear the glasses. But also, like writing. If I don't have time to just kind of write when I'm by myself and just kind of, you know, and I've heard preachers say, man, if they don't preach for a while, they kind of feel like they almost, you know, almost are constipated mentally because they need to preach. Well, I'm not that way speaking, but I am that way writing. I just need to kind of, and that builds me, that renews me. Other things, you know, I love to design, I love to build, I love to, you know, if I can build a deck and, you know, design it and build it and research it and actually see it come to fruition, that's awesome. And you guys have different things for yourself. Renewal, you know, even in your rest, in how you rest. My body needs like 8 or 9 hours of sleep a night. I hate that about myself. I envy guys who say they sleep on 4 hours a night and they're fine. I wish that were me, but I know that about myself. That's not me. So you kind of got to know yourself and know what builds you and know what's gonna suck the life out of you as well. So think about that. Think about kind of what it is that builds into you so you can create those margins. Last thing on margins I want to talk about is just to kind of control your calendar. A lot of us go through cycles where our calendar is completely out of control, where we're at the mercy of our calendar. And so I think paying attention to that's really important. Have you guys seen the Stephen Covey illustration where he fills a jar with big rocks and little rocks? And you know, if he puts the little rocks in first, hardly any of the big rocks fit. But if he puts the big rocks in first, he can get all of them in, and then several of the little rocks as well. And he's just saying, pay attention to what are the big rocks in your life. The big rock, if you're married, it's probably your marriage, your spouse. So that would be a big rock. And you have to calendar time if that's an important relationship. A big rock, if you have kids, is probably your relationship with your kids. You know, big rock is probably your relationship with God. And calendaring that time and making sure that that's part of your schedule. In your work life, a big rock for me would be kind of the leaders. I've got 8 on my team that report to me, and pouring into them is a big deal for me. And if I'm kind of just the tyranny of the urgent and answering emails and whatever, you know, whoever comes to my office, I'll never have time for those really important conversations. So even things like, and I mentioned a minute ago, of like vacation, schedule your vacation. A lot of times I talk to guys in ministry or men or women in ministry, and they say, you know, I'm thinking about taking a long weekend off next month. I'm just going to kind of, I think maybe I'll have time to do that. I'm going to wait and see. I'm like, wait and see? Are you kidding? I mean, if you wait and see if you're going to have time on your calendar, you'll never have time on your calendar. Get things like vacation, renewal weekends, whatever it is, get them on your calendar way ahead of time. Date nights, you know, with your wife or with your kids, get those on the schedule way ahead of time. We have four kids in our family, two girls and two boys, and I used to call it date night with all the kids, and as the boys got older, I had to start calling it guys night, because date night seems a little weird for them. So for us, it's date night and guys night. Manage, if you travel much for conferences or speaking or whatever, then manage that as well. When I was in local church ministry, I didn't travel a ton, but it started to grow over time, and I realized that it was kind of getting out of hand. And so since I kind of keep everything on my calendar, I went back and, you know, started counting it up, and it was like, you know, 1 year was 14 nights away, and the next year was 22 nights away, and the next year was 28 nights away, and it was kind of growing beyond where I wanted it to be. And so I just sat down with my wife and with my boss and said, hey, let's figure out kind of what's a healthy amount for me, because part of our ministry was ministry to other churches, so I did need to travel some. But so we kind of settled on a number, and then every year after that, I would just kind of sit down with them at the end of the year and say, okay, here's what our goal was, here's what actually happened, did it feel right, did it feel like too much, too little, and to be able to evaluate that. Another thing I would say on calendar-wise is you got to go home before the work is done, and that sounds elementary. But in church work, we can convince ourselves to stay late every day of the week because eternity is at stake and the cause is on the line and there's big things we're doing and people's lives matter. But so do our families, and so does our own personal health. So we got to go home before the work is done. And last note on this is just, and this goes to margin and related to your calendar, is leave room for people and leave room for God. So leave some space, some flex space on your calendar. My associate I used to work with, instead of accidents or accidental conversations, he called them God-a-dents, you know, when someone would just come in and need to talk for like an hour and kind of pour their life out. You know, leaving space for that is important. Having that buffer. A lot of times, us as church leaders, the only time our parishioners, congregants, people in the church see us is on Sunday morning or Saturday night or whenever your service is. And a lot of times that's the time we're the busiest and we're going bzz, 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 back and forth and from point A to point B. And, you know, we're not even stopping to shake someone's hand. We're kind of like on the move as we're shaking their hand. And that communicates to them we're too busy. You know, we don't have time. We don't have space. And so those times when the people that we're called to minister to are there is when we need to make some space. So that's kind of the personal margin calendar stuff. Any thoughts, questions, comments? I want to move on to talk a little bit about staffing. Everyone good? So the second thing that I would say of the four that we're talking about today is give more energy to hiring, and if it's volunteers, selecting, but give more energy to hiring than just about anything else you do. More energy, focus, time. I mean, most church leaders receive little or no training on how to hire people. I mean, that's not a topic in most seminaries I've heard of. You don't learn about that. Maybe you do if you like have a business degree or something like that. But there's a lot of things to that. So a few things that I want to talk about related to bringing people on the team. One is that I really have this strong belief, and this will sound strange because I like work for a search group that helps churches find staff. But I really am a strong proponent of hiring from within. No matter what your size is, whether you're small or large, you know, hiring from within is, I think, huge. When I left my church, we had 129 on staff. 123 of them were internal hires. We'd only hired six from outside the organization. Now, sometimes to qualify for an internal hire means we brought you on as an intern for 9 months and then hired you, and then we considered you an internal hire because you kind of lived with us for a period of time. But I think that's huge. When I was at Granger just maybe 10 years or so, the church was about 15 years old, I did a survey. I kind of looked through all of our hiring history for the whole time the church had been in existence. And I categorized between successful hires and unsuccessful. Successful means they're still on staff and things are going well. Or maybe they left, but it was a good leave. Unsuccessful means it's not going well, or it was a dramatic leave, a bad leave. If you've been through one of those, you know what bad leave means. So I kind of categorized them that way, and then also categorized them by internal versus external hires. On the internal hires, it was 95% were successful in the successful column, and 5% didn't go well. On the external hires, it was 50-50. 50%. Now, maybe we just did a terrible job with external hires. I'd like to think in my company now that we do a better job matching culture and chemistry. But it's really hard when you're hiring from outside to be able to do that. Lots of advantages to hiring from within. You get to see someone under pressure. You know, a lot of times, if you're hiring from within, you're probably looking from the base of your volunteers, your volunteer leaders. So you get to see them leading. You get to see their faithfulness. You get to see their character. You get to see their strengths and weaknesses. You get a chance to see every new employee will bring you surprises. You just have fewer surprises when it's someone that you already have some experience with, you have some knowledge with. You already know with an internal hire that they not only can read and agree to your values or to your mission, but they embrace it. They own it. It's kind of in them already. You know, when I transitioned to this new organization 2 years ago, you know, I knew what the 9 values were of Vanderbloom and Search Group. Read them on paper, right? But you don't really know what they mean until you get there. It's like, oh, you know, ridiculous responsiveness is one of our values. Oh, that's what it means. That's what it looks like. Our team tries to answer the phone or tries to get back to someone within 60 seconds of the time that they fill out a form and say, hey, we need some help at our church. 60 seconds is our goal. That's ridiculous responsiveness. That like redefined it for me. And so but you don't know in your church, what is the, you know, what do those values mean until you're there? With internal hires, you got that figured out, right? You already know that. Internal hires, you already know they buy into the mission, the vision. They understand the philosophy of ministry. So hire from within when you can. The second thing would be connected to this, and you're going to think I'm schizophrenic, but don't hire from within at specific times, okay? There are times when you need a fresh perspective, when you need some clear eyes. If your church is plateaued or declining, you probably, if it was going to grow, it would be growing, right? So you might need some new leadership. You need some new eyes, some fresh ideas, some perspectives, some innovation. If you're running a ministry within the church, let's say children's ministry, and the church is kind of growing, but children's ministry isn't, or the church is growing, but student ministry isn't, or small groups aren't, then you probably need some fresh eyes, some fresh perspective. If you just raise someone up from within, it's going to operate like it has been, and you'll need some outside eyes on that. I like Scott Williams called it the inbred syndrome. He said one of the reasons big companies fail is they're unwilling to bring outside people into the organization to infuse new ideas. And I don't have hardly any regrets for my 20 years at Granger. One of them is I wish when we kind of started, we were kind of, you know, rocket ship growth for about 18 years, and then we started doing this. And I wish at that point we would have brought in some, infused some fresh ideas and some new ideas into the equation. With outside hires, they definitely require more work. It's the converse of what I said of what makes it great with an internal hire. An outside hire will take more work onboarding. They'll take more time from you just explaining the values. They will ask annoying questions that everyone that's internal knows not to ask, right? Because we've asked those before and it hasn't gone well. So they ask those questions. And sometimes they need just kind of educated. Other times they, like, you need to think about that question because it's an annoying question for a reason. And you really need to consider that. I found it takes 2 to 3 years for an outside hire to like be fully settled and comfortable and be infused with the DNA of the church and really kind of, okay, they own it now. They get it. They're one of us. They're with us. They're leading. So it takes a long time to figure that out. So that's fresh eyes. Any comments or questions about hiring from within or hiring from outside when you're selecting staff or volunteer leaders? That's a great question. That's one of the hard things about hiring from within is the relationships are there. So when we were hiring my administrative assistant a few years back, that's the one I remember specifically because I was so involved in it. We got 125 resumes from internal, which means 124 people at least are going to be disappointed with their church that they didn't get the job, and which is a hard thing to work through. We would typically try not to advertise for positions. We'd much rather kind of crowdsource it with our staff and our team, just who do you know, here's a position that's open, who do you know, so that we didn't have so many disappointed people when we went through that. But that's, I don't know, I don't think you can avoid it. I think it's just straight conversations and, man, we still love you and we're glad you're on the team, you know, but we just don't think you're fit for this role. I think you work as hard as you can to make it work. So, you know, if it's real bad, then maybe it's less than a year, but I try to give it at least a year, year and a half to see. I think part of where we mess up is that margin thing again. So as leaders, we don't have margin to coach the new people coming in. So they come in, we spend a couple days of frantic download with them, you know, read this stuff, look at this, read this book, whatever. And then we kind of send them off, and then the next re-engagement with them is conflict. It's like something, they went off the rails, and we had to kind of pull them back on. So am I talking to the person who's coming in or the person who's, okay. So if I was talking to the person, I mean, to me, God has wired certain people to lead, and I think that, Hybels calls it a holy discontent. I think that holy discontent emerges, and sometimes it can look to leaders like disloyalty or like lack of faithfulness or rebellion, or they won't fall in line, or they're not a good follower. But I think a lot of times that's just God kind of birthing in someone this thing that they need to lead. And I talk to lots of guys every week, men and women every week, that God's just kind of wired them to lead, and their time, it's time. And they need to be in an organization where they can be in the number one chair. And I don't think that's jealousy. I don't think it's disloyalty. I think it's some people are just wired that way, and that's what they need to do. And I have had guys, men and women in the church that you can see the frustration building. And I'll just say, dude, man, just free yourself. We'll help you. We'll help you transition. We'll give you an off ramp, a long off ramp. But God's wired you to do something, you know, where you can really lead this thing. Does that make sense? Does that help? Okay. Anything else? Third thing under this, and under this point of paying attention to hiring, or some real kind of quick bullets here. One is that I think resumes are pretty much worthless. Resumes are worth, and I've got 50 some thousand resumes in my system right now. So I look at lots of resumes. But I think resumes tell you a person's education and the jobs that they held. And those are important, but those are less valuable than a lot of other things I want to know, like about their leadership ability and capacity, and what have they actually grown. If you look in their wake of their life, what have they grown in the past? I'm curious about their skills that wouldn't necessarily show up in the positions that they've held, but they've got certain skills and aptitudes. Their passion, their heart, what are they excited about? What do they wake up thinking about every day? Chemistry is a huge one that doesn't show up on resumes. You know, does someone have chemistry with you? I shared the illustration this morning that I heard Hybels talk about chemistry, and he said, you know you have chemistry with someone if your phone buzzes right now, it's one of the people on your team, and you look at it, and as soon as you see their name, what is your instant thought in your head or your heart? You know, is it kind of like, or, you know, is it a sense of excitement? Well, sometimes that relates to chemistry. It's just like you got someone on the team that's just, it just feels like a drag every time you have to engage with them. That a lot of times deals with chemistry. And especially in church plants and small staff, chemistry with everyone on the team is hugely important. It becomes less important if you have a staff of 50 or 60. You need to have chemistry with kind of your five or six team, but you don't necessarily with 60 people. But it's really important when you're starting out. It says so much about how you're setting culture. We also talked this morning about character. I want to say a few things about that. That character can't be trained. Character can't be trained. This is very confusing for us as church leaders because our whole life is revolves around helping transform people's character. I mean, it's what the church is about. Taking people where they're at, introducing them to Jesus if they haven't been, helping them take steps to become more Christ-like in their faith. So we can confuse that and sometimes look at church staff or church leadership as part of the maturity process or part of the recovery process in some cases. And man, that'll catch up with you long term. I think people don't need to be perfect, but they need to have certain characteristics in their life. They need to have certain character flaws that they have moved past. Things that are important: words, money, and sex. You know, they need to have their tongue under control. They need to not be mesmerized by money, because people will handle money with, you know, retreat registrations or high school fees or offerings and so forth. So they can't be mesmerized by money. That's why we do credit checks. You know, if someone has a huge amount of debt, it's overwhelming, it's excessive compared to their income, then they're going to they potentially are going to be more susceptible to influences with money. So that's important. And then, you know, sex, both for guys and women. I mean, that's an issue that's coming up more all the time, and it can do so much to kind of take a church down or derail a church for a period of time. So it's real important. And I think asking the right questions up front is helpful, but it's not a fail-safe. You know, sometimes when someone on your team fails or falls in one of these areas, you can kind of beat yourself up and thinking, man, how did I not see that? Well, anyone who falls into one of these areas does it for the first time at some point. So it doesn't necessarily mean they had a history of it. I think we can do a lot to communicate health and to have an environment that is healthy, that's not overly excessive stress, you know, excessively stressful or tense. But we're ultimately not responsible when someone makes a personal choice like that. When someone tells me that they messed up in the past, in the interview process, in the vetting process, man, that's gold. I'd much prefer that. If they don't tell you about it and you find out about it through the interview process, instant red flag. I mean, instant red light, really. It's instantly you're no longer being considered for this. Because if you're trying to hide that, what else are you trying to hide? There's other things that may be there as well. But I hired a campus pastor a few years back, and he had been fired from the church that he planted in his previous role a few years prior. And I loved it when we talked about it because I didn't know about it. And when we sat down and talked about it, he said, Tim, just so you know, I got fired 2 years ago. And this is what I did that was wrong, where I was wrong. And this is what I was accused of in that whole mess that I didn't do, but it was part of the mess. And he said, and he gave me the names and numbers of three people still in the church that were involved in the process. He said, you can call any of these three and ask them questions and kind of get that side of the story as well. I love that. And we did dig into it and do the reference calls, ultimately hired him. And he ended up being a tremendous staff person. Pay attention to character. That's really important. Stalk your potential hires. Did you have a question?
Just back to character.
Yeah. Yeah, so a couple things on that. One, we have hundreds of articles on interviewing and recruiting candidates on vanderblumen.com. Click the, I think it's the blogs or the articles tab, and then there's a search bar. So you can just enter interviews or whatever, and you'll find a bunch of stuff there. I would say one of the things that we really poke around on in our interviewing process when we're doing this for churches is transitions. Why did you leave there? Why didn't you stay longer? How did you leave? You know, did you get fired? Whose choice was it for you to leave? Why did you stay out of ministry so long before your next engagement in ministry? You know, those, I think transitions are huge. You know, what did you do while you were there as far as ministry goes? And then probably transitions. You know, why did you leave? You know, you look at someone who's been at five different places for 2 years or 3 years or less. That's not always bad, but it's a yellow flag. It's something you want to dig into and ask questions about. I think the references on some of the things, like, you can't really, chemistry you can't test for. There's no tools for that. You really have to spend time with the person. But you can, like, the things on money and words, you can ask leading questions in the references. And if you get any kind of prick of, like, just, there seems like there's something here. Then I ask the candidate, give me some more references. We need to, you know, call some additional ones. We used to ask the references for further references, kind of secondary ones. It's really hard these days to do that because you really can put their job in jeopardy, you know, by more people finding out. And a lot of times, if they're gainfully employed, they aren't necessarily wanting to be public there about their search. So that's sometimes hard. On stalking your potential hires, I'm talking about social media. Man, what a great tool we have that generations before us, even as, you know, 12 or 15 years ago, didn't have. My kids call it creeping, you know, if I'm looking, you know, it's out there. I'm, you know, they call it, and they say, hey, Dad, you're creeping. It's like, well, it's on the Internet. But Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Pinterest, blogs, you know, in these, I'm looking for what do people post? You know, what do they put up? What are the pictures that they put up? That they, you know, it kind of tells you a little bit maybe about chemistry. It tells you a little bit about just what's important to them. I like to read posts to see how they think, or articles that they link to see what they find interesting, what they say about their spouse or their kids. Do they act like they love their family, that their family is a high priority for them? Biggest one for me is find out how they treat people that they disagree with on the internet, because people are mean, right? And I don't want to hire one of those mean people. So do they treat people with grace when it's a conversation, difference of politics or a difference of parenting styles or a difference of theology or denomination or whatever? How do they treat those people that come at them or have a disagreement with them? Do they cross over the inappropriate line, often or at all? And what are they interested in? You can find a little bit about chemistry by, where do they go on vacation? What books do they read? And what movies do they like? And what do they do with their kids? And where do they like to hang out? And all that kind of stuff. You can find out some on chemistry. Hugely important, totally legal. There's nothing, I would totally ignore anything that is said about them by someone else. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about their page, their Instagram feed, their Twitter feed, the stuff that is represents themselves. That is definitely open game for looking at. There was a study from the University of Evansville. They were looking at companies that use social media to hire. And they said in this study, they found out that employers were able to determine with a surprising level of accuracy personality traits and indicators to predict future job performance based on that person's social media presence. So they said more than resumes and more than interviews, social media told them more about that person's future job performance, which is fascinating, right? And if you're like, I don't even know how to do it, just ask anyone who's like 24 or younger and make them your social media czar and say, hey, I'm going to throw a name at you every now and then. I just want you to tell me what you learned. So those things can be really valuable. Anything on that, social media? Third kind of big topic here is to intentionally build your culture. Intentionally build your culture. And kind of what I mean by culture, right now I'm kind of talking not so much your church culture, but your team, whatever your leadership team, whether it's staff or volunteers, kind of what that culture looks like. So here's some things that I think are signs of a great culture to kind of help define what I mean by this. People are waiting in line to join your team. You hear comments like, man, I'd do anything to be on staff with you guys, or I'd do anything to be on your leadership team. Even though they know the pay is probably less than what they're making now, or likely less, it's still a sense of like, man, I'd love to be involved in that. Turnover is low. You don't have a lot of turnover. People come and they stay for a long time. I think if on those two, first two, if you had people waiting in line to come to the team, but then leave after 6 months, that tells you that the culture isn't that positive. It looks shiny on the outside, but once you get there, it's not that shiny. So both of those things, I think, are true. Another one is that top leaders, like the pastor, let's say, they're not insecure about other people succeeding in the organization. They love to see other leaders rise up. They love it. They love to have someone on their team that's a better leader than them in certain areas. I think where there's great culture, gossip isn't tolerated. So it's not just like someone preaches against it, but like if you just, tried to gossip in the hallway, someone would say, dude, we don't do that here. You got to go talk to the person. So just kind of laterally, we're shutting that down. That's another one is lateral leadership is outstanding. I think the hardest type of leadership is lateral leadership. So, leading people below you is, it's got its challenges, but compared to leading people beside you that you have no power over, no influence over, you do have influence, no power, no authority over, but you only have your influence. And I think in a positive culture, lateral leadership is great. Team members are energized by the mission. You can feel, it's not just on the wall somewhere. You can kind of talk to anyone on the team and they talk about the mission. I think also it's not just a job. People do life together outside of the ministry context or outside of the church context. Doesn't mean that's the only people you do life with, but they enjoy hanging out together. In a positive culture, the team believes they're more important than the task. In a negative culture, you can feel like you're just kind of like making widgets or, I'm just putting together the children's curriculum and no one really notices, or I'm just answering the phones and no one really notices. In a positive culture, it's communicated from top to bottom that you are the one that's valuable, more important than the task. Real simple, in a positive culture, people are smiling. I'm in a different church building every week of the year, and you can sense just walking through the hallways if there's a positive culture or negative culture. People, you know, having fun, joking together, living life together. In a positive culture, fear is missing. You don't have the eggshell kind of thing, you know, where you're like, oh, can't, we're near the accountant or the HR person or the audio guy or the janitor or whatever. We got to be careful. You know, fear is missing. You don't have these hushed conversations because of fear. Two more things under what's a great culture is communication is strong. You know, from the top to the bottom, people communicate. The staff isn't surprised when they, you know, hear something for the first time announced at a Sunday service. But people are really, the communication happens readily. And then also change is welcome in a positive culture. No, hardly anyone likes change, but if you've seen change handled well, handled great, you know, and it's like, man, we've changed like four things in the last 2 years. I had a church just tell me, some church staff members just tell me this a few weeks ago. They said they weren't scared about this senior pastor changing because they said, look at the things that have, major things that have changed in the last 3 or 4 years, and we got through them, and we're stronger, and we're better off, and it was managed well. And so change is welcome. Change is, we're open to change. We're excited about it. So that's related to culture. One thing that people would ask me constantly when I was at Granger was, they said, okay, you know, it seems like a really great culture here. A lot of these things are true. You know, give us the one secret. Give us the one key. And you know, I would say there isn't one secret, one key. But I would say there was one kind of practice that we did, kind of tangible practice that we did that every week. That was probably lent more to a positive culture than just about any other tangible thing that we did. And that was our weekly staff meeting. And usually when I say that, people look, you know, get silent, and they're like, I was hoping for something a little more profound than that. But we would do a weekly staff meeting, and we would orient it around three kind of big bucket things. Now, this, just so you know, this staff meeting had, this was the entire staff. This had nothing to do with getting anything decided. We weren't trying to get anything done in the staff meeting. It wasn't about pushing forward an agenda. It was about building culture. That was the purpose of, and it was, you know, as the staff grew, it was an expensive staff meeting when you have, you know, 60 people sitting still in a room, not being productive, then it's got to be pretty important to what you're doing. So the three things we did, if you're a Baptist, you'll love it because they're alliterated. We did stories, spotlight, and stuff. That's not a good one, but that's the best I could come up with. Stories, spotlight, stuff. So on the stories, we'd spend the first 15 or 20 minutes just telling, we called them God stories. We would come in a room like this, and whoever was running the meeting at the front would start the meeting and say, hey, where have you seen God at work in the life of the church in the last 7 days? You know, where's God been at work in your small group? Where have you heard stories of how God's working? And people would just kind of tell stories, you know, kind of cross-departmental stories about where they saw God working. And it wasn't all, and very few of them were like, you know, when the pastor said on Sunday morning, it was like life on life stuff. It was came out of small groups and out of hallways and out of conversations and out of homes and families. And so that was cool. And what that did, those stories, is it kept the silos, you know, that naturally build around departments in any church. It kept them kind of down because there was a sense of like, we're not the only ones getting anything done around here. Look at the story we just heard from this area over here, this campus over here, this department over here. And it gave us a reason to celebrate kind of what God was doing across the ministry. The second thing we did, the second kind of big S, would be spotlight. So we would do a staff spotlight. And if you have more than probably 10 or 12 people in your nucleus, then this will work for you. If you have more than 10 or 12 people, then there's probably people you don't know very well. And maybe even if you're a church plant with 6 people, there's people you don't know very well. But we would do a staff spotlight where we would just randomly call someone from the room up to the front of the room. They didn't know ahead of time. And we'd say, hey, we're going to put, you know, Joe on the hot seat today. And we would spend 5 or 10 minutes and we'd say, ask Joe anything you want just to learn about him. And so people would ask about, you know, tell us about your kids and tell us when you first moved to the area and tell us when you came to know Jesus and tell us, you know, what's on your playlist right now and what's the best movie you've gone to this year? Just kind of learning about him. And then we'd stop and say, now let's tell Joe why we're glad he's on the team. Why are you glad Joe is on our team? And people just pour life into Joe. And, you know, in a larger group, a lot of people don't even know him that well, but it's just a sense of, man, you always seem like you're happier. You always show up early and stay late. Or, man, you really poured into me when my kid was sick last summer, and you were at my house every night for the whole week. You know, things like that. And you learn, I mean, even people that are a little annoyed by Joe, begin to see that, man, he's got purpose and value. And Joe goes home feeling like he's walking on air. And it's the things that you say at the funeral after the person who you're talking about is no longer there. It's those things that we get to say. I learned this this practice. We started doing this when my oldest daughter, who's now 23, was in first grade. So a long time ago, right? So they invited the parents and the siblings to first grade because she was student of the week for her classroom. Very cool, right? She got to make a poster and all that. And so we didn't really know what student of the week meant. But student of the week meant we'd come and we'd sit. She'd sit on the chair in the middle, and her siblings and me and her mom would sit kind of around. And that's what they would do. They would say, hey, let's, and all the kids were sitting on the floor in front, you know, Indian style, crisscross applesauce, sorry. And they would just begin to pour life into Heather and tell her why they loved her as a friend and why they were glad. She was on clouds for days after that. And we were too, right, as parents. So we just took that first grade little thing back and brought it to our staff meeting. It's been a wonderful thing. The third thing, that's all to build culture in this weekly staff meeting. Third thing we do is we just put under the category of stuff. So a lot of times it's communication, what's coming, what you need to know. We found that our leaders, our core leaders, our staff, they love kind of uncooked, unpublic information, stuff that's just kind of, it's still kind of cooking in the pot. It's not quite ready yet for the table, but you're just thinking about it. And so we would come out of our executive staff meetings and say, hey, here's a series we're thinking about doing this Christmas. We haven't decided yet, but we're just kind of noodling on it. Just want you guys to know, and if you have ideas, let us know. You know, or here's something we're thinking about doing next summer. Or sometimes we would have just one of the pastors would just kind of talk, just here's what God's teaching me. That would kind of be in that stuff category as well. And it wasn't the polished, packaged, put together, 3 points in a poem Sunday delivery, but it was more kind of just real informal, raw, kind of heart to heart. And our staff loved that, and it really pulled them together and pulled them into just the fact that none of us are perfect, and we're all in this together, and we're pushing through this together. So those three things, huge. I think for us, that one thing every week, just doing it, I mean, consistently, probably for the last 15 years I was there, did more to probably generate a great culture than just about anything else. Last thing I'm going to talk about, we only got like 10 minutes left, is the fourth thing. Big bucket thing here is to guard your culture. Once you have built a culture, you got to guard the culture. You really got to pay attention to that. And a few things here that to think about. If you think about your church kind of being, you know, whatever you figured out is your mission, vision, and values, and you're going in a certain direction, and there's a lot of churches not going in the same direction as you, and that's okay, but you've kind of defined that this is where we're going as a church, and it's different. But it's kind of our unique secret sauce for how we're reaching the community. And some of that has to do with theology, and some of it has to do with practice and style and attractional or missional. Lots of different things enter into that. But you kind of decide that as a church. And church plants go through this. You're usually deciding that on the front side as you're planting. Established churches tend to go through it. We probably, in my 20 years there, if you include the church plant before I got there, probably three other big times when we went through and just kind of reevaluated where we're going as a church. Just look at, you know, do we still agree with the mission? And we did. We never changed that while I was there. Do we still agree with the vision? Well, we would shake that up every few years, you know. Or what are our values? What really kind of describes how we live life together? So you kind of define that as a church. And then you get people to come along and you want them to go in the same direction. And in an ideal world, everyone's going in the same direction. When you have a church that's 20 or 25 or 30 years old, it's a little bit cyclical. There'll be times when things are humming and all the leaders are headed in the same direction as the church, and that's awesome. And you are able to, your intense conversation and debates are over how do we do this better? How do we reach more people, which is great. You don't want to be debating the bylaws or the Constitution. So when you're doing that, that's great. And you'll also, as the church gets older, you'll have cycles where it's like, man, things are a little muddy. Like, we're not sure we even agree together what this big arrow is. So how can we know if we're in sync on it? And then, you know, every now and then you have someone who's just kind of a few degrees off. And, you know, we actually call them in our context the crooked arrow. We'd say, hey, we think we got a crooked arrow. Usually this wasn't about theology, hardly ever. I can't think of any time when it was a theological issue. It was almost always some method. It was the worship style. It was how loud we played the music. It was what we were doing or not doing in men's ministry or women's ministry, or whether we had a choir or a choral ensemble or none of those. It was a prayer ministry. We just didn't do enough in prayer ministry. We didn't do prayer ministry the right ways. Someone who would typically come in with a churched background who did something differently at a different place, and that was kind of the thing that they harped on all the time, and they became a crooked arrow. So the first time they have a conversation with you, that doesn't mean they're a crooked arrow. That just means you need to kind of say, yeah, I totally get, I hear where you're coming from, but let me tell you again, and you kind of redefine the big arrow. This is the direction we're going. But then it's the second or the third conversation. And then sometimes these folks will begin to kind of sow discord, kind of ask questions in larger groups, kind of begin to plant some attitude issues. So many times this person would come to you and they'll say something like this. They'll say, you have no idea how many people in this church agree with me on this issue. Like, you don't know who they are. It might be their brother and their cousin, but it sounds like it's hundreds of people. I mean, the way they talk about it. And crooked arrows, people that are misaligned, that needs to be addressed. That needs to be taken care of. And especially it affects attitudes. It affects your values. You will find, like, when you have a crooked arrow on a team, like a nursery team or a first impressions team, a lot of times if you have to ask that person to step down after several conversations, you say, you know what, we need you to step out of volunteering for a while because you're just not happy about how things are going on and that's making us not happy. You will find a lot of times that team will come and thank you because they saw it long before you did. And you'll also see, maybe you might have had people just cycling through, burning out on that team because they don't want to be around that. And so you might see people stay longer. You just kind of see the joy just increase in that area. So make sure to pay attention to guarding your culture. One last quick diagram. This is not original with me. I learned this from, I think it was Jack Welch from GE. But he had this kind of matrix, and he would say down here would be, you know, your values, your DNA as a church, your culture, the things that define who you are, that make you kind of unique and not like every other church in town. So that would be values. And if you were on this end of the scale, then you had high values, high DNA, great attitude. You owned the culture. And if you're on this end, then it's like, nah, they don't get us. It's not, there's something's not clicking. And on this scale would be performance. You can't read my writing, but trust me, it says performance. And at the top end would be a really high performer, someone who is knocking the ball out of the park, let's say in student ministry. You know, they're just, man, more kids coming every week. It's awesome. Down here, negative would be not a great performer. You know, we have fewer small groups this year than we had last year, and the church is still growing, so something's not right. So then there'd be kind of four categories of people on this. You've got people who have low values, low DNA, low culture, and they're low performers. So they don't get us as a church. They don't get our culture. Bad attitude. And they're not performing. No brainer, right? Jack Welch would say they shouldn't be on your team. You've known for weeks or months that you should have fired them. If that person just popped into your mind, the decision's probably already been made. On the positive end, if you got someone, and on the positive end down here, this is the person that you want, like any newcomer, any guest who came to your church, you would send them to this person because they get your church. They own it. You know, they, as much as a paid staff person, this volunteer gets it as well, or this, even a lower level staff person, they get it. They understand it. They own it. So if you have someone up here, they understand the values and the culture and the DNA, and they're a great performer, a no-brainer, he would say reward them. You know, in Jack Welch's world, he'd give them a $50,000 car. We're probably not going to do that, but we can figure out ways to reward them. Maybe it's a raise. Maybe it's a weekend with their wife at a hotel. Maybe, you know, something. Figure out a way. Figure out what speaks to them. Let them know that these people are crucial to your organization. If they're in this, or let me do this space first. If they're in this space, so great DNA, man. You want them on the team. They're just not great at what they're doing. Then he would say either retrain or transfer. A lot of times in smaller churches, church plants, we can't transfer. We don't have that many positions. But we can try to retrain them, get them better at it. Sometimes I've transferred people from a staff position to a volunteer position, and they've been absolutely happy after time because it just fit them better. If you can retrain them, that's great for transfer. This is the hardest one of all, because if they're a high performer, like they run small groups, and man, we got twice as many small groups as we did a year ago, but they have a stinky attitude and they don't even quite understand why we exist as a church, then you have to address that. It's very hard to address because it doesn't make sense to a lot of people, but you have to address it. And they would say, you know, have a 30-day conversation, meaning kind of a shape up or ship out kind of conversation, because this is, values are so important for our organization, for the church, that we're not going to risk it just because things are up and to the right in your ministry area. So this has to be fixed, and we're going to give you some tangible things to repair that. Otherwise, we're not going to have a place for you here anymore. Tough conversations, I know. It's 3:30, so I don't want to keep any longer. Any questions, last-minute questions, conversation? Yeah.
How can you define they get the culture, they get the DNA, or they don't get the DNA?
How do you define it?
Yeah, what's the best way to define that?
I think in attitude, you see that in attitude, you see... you know, if they're that crooked arrow, they don't get it because they're kind of keep pushing against. If you feel like they're pulling with you versus pushing against you in your conversations about that stuff, I think that'd be part of it. I'll stay up here. I'll hang up here, but I won't let you go on time. So thanks for coming.